You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. American and British troops used vast amounts of depleted uranium in both Desert Storm and the more recent attack on Iraq. Critics of the toxic heavy metal byproduct of the nuclear fuel and weapons industries says it causes ill health effects and cancer among the soldiers using the weapons, the armies they target, and civilians, leading to birth defects in children. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Doug Rocky, who directed the U.S. Department of Defense's post-first Gulf War depleted uranium desert cleanup, has said use of depleted uranium is a war crime. But while British soldiers returning from the Gulf will be tested for exposure to the toxic metal, U.S. Pentagon official Dr. Michael Kilpatrick and CNN have cited studies that fail to show a direct link between exposure to depleted uranium and human disease. The latest use of depleted uranium in the current conflict came last week when an American A-10 tank buster plane fired a DU shell, killing one British soldier and injuring three others in a friendly fire incident. KPFT's Mark Babawi spoke recently with retired U.S. Navy Gulf War veteran Dan Fahey about these issues and discussed the use of depleted uranium, something Fahey says may be akin to the use of weapons of mass destruction.
It's somewhat true to say that there are, that studies have failed to show a link, but we have to ask why that is, and the answer is that really the studies haven't been done. There have been a lot of laboratory studies done in the last decade by the Department of Defense, and what those laboratory studies have found is that depleted uranium causes cancer in rats, causes genetic damage, neurological effects, reproductive effects. So they found a range of things that are very serious, and in fact, they continue to expand their research on rats. But when it comes to human populations, very few people have been examined or their health has been assessed. We have a very small study here in the U.S. of veterans from the 1991 Gulf War. And even though the Pentagon has admitted that thousands of veterans during the 91 war may have been exposed to depleted uranium, they've only assessed the health, they use a number of 70, but in 2001, they only looked at 39 veterans out of these thousands that they say may have been exposed. And so we have a very limited understanding of how depleted uranium has affected veterans in this country. But in other countries as well, there really haven't been good studies. The Iraqi studies that have been done on this have a lot of flaws in them. And it's my hope that now in the aftermath of this war, that one of the bright things that can come out of it is that we do have a better assessment of the health status of the Iraqi people, not just looking at depleted uranium, but certainly looking at depleted uranium and the effect it's had on the health of the people there.
We haven't really heard much about, as you said, the effect on U.S. veterans. At the last Gulf War, a figure of 79 or 80 coalition soldiers was thrown around as the number of casualties. Do you have any idea of how many veterans have died since and how many are suffering other ill effects to do with their exposure to DU and other materials?
Well, the Department of Veterans Affairs has released numbers about the of veterans that have died according to their figures, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000, but there's no real breakdown in terms of how many of those have been caused by the health effects from the war.
And 10,000 have died since the Gulf War.
Yeah, but from all causes. That could be anything from a car accident to cancer.
Okay.
So it's really difficult to say in terms of death and mortality, how many veterans have died from depleted uranium or from other exposures. Certainly we know that more than 100,000 veterans have taken the medical exam offered by the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense for veterans who believe they have health problems related to the war. So it's a very large problem. But one of the things about depleted uranium is that the latency period for development of cancers is generally considered to be 10 to 30 years. So we've just entered that time frame now, where for veterans who had significant exposures to depleted uranium, we may begin to see an increase in cancers. But unfortunately, the Department of Defense, which calls the shots on this issue within the government, is not allowing a proper study to be done of veterans who were exposed. So we may never really know the extent of the effects of depleted uranium on veterans' health.
And when you were there during the previous conflict, what was the attitude of the soldiers that you were in contact with to this issue? Did they have any idea of what they were actually handling?
Well, I should mention I wasn't there during the war. I was on a ship that arrived right after the war.
Okay.
But throughout the 1990s, I worked as a paralegal helping veterans file disability claims. And through that work, I worked with hundreds of Gulf War veterans who had a range of experiences during the war. And part of what got me interested in this issue to begin with was that so many of the veterans, I mean, well over 90% of the veterans I talked to had no clue what I was talking about when I mentioned depleted uranium. But then when I would say, well, did you climb on tanks that had been destroyed during the war? You know, virtually everyone said yes. But they had never been told that tanks that are shot by depleted uranium rounds become contaminated with a fine dust that poses mainly an inhalation hazard, and that, you know, they're at risk of developing health problems from that exposure. So people really had no understanding what I was talking about. And one of the things that we did accomplish during the 90s was to get the Department of Defense to begin a training program for everyone who's in the military, so that at a minimum, people are told, you know, stay away from tanks that have been destroyed. But the extent to which that message is being disseminated, we're still not sure. And it's really not adequate. The training is not adequate for the hazard that exists.
Now, the use of DU, the kind of the defense of it that's often given by the Pentagon and others, is that it's almost crucial in the way the U.S. Strategizes the war and how it, treats things on the field. Do you think that holds true, or is there some other reason that might be motivating?
Well, depleted uranium does work well at penetrating tank armor, but the Pentagon has vastly overstated the importance of depleted uranium for our arsenal. And when you look at some of the statements that have been made, they sometimes make it sound as if depleted uranium won the 91 war, when in fact fewer than 1 in 7 tanks that were destroyed during that war were hit by depleted uranium. Really, the most effective weapons that the military uses to destroy tanks are guided missiles. The A-10 aircraft, which has shot over 85% of all of the DU that's been used in all of the wars that we've fought since 91, in 91 only hit 100 tanks with their DU bullets, but they destroyed 900 tanks with the Maverick missile. So the Pentagon has really overstated the importance of depleted uranium for our arsenal in an attempt to get people, or to justify in people's minds the health and environmental risks that result from using it. Mm-hmm. So it's really very disingenuous, and particularly in the last few months, the Pentagon has really undertaken a strong propaganda campaign on depleted uranium, which has included presenting very misleading information about the health and environmental effects, what their own studies know, which has also included vastly overstating the importance of depleted uranium ammunition, and has even gone so far as to misrepresent the findings and recommendations of various international organizations that have chimed in on this issue, including the British Royal Society, which 2 weeks ago publicly criticized the Pentagon and said that the Pentagon had been misrepresenting their findings on depleted uranium, and they said depleted uranium does need to be cleaned up in Iraq and the civilians need to be warned. But, you know, the Pentagon spokesmen, including Michael Kilpatrick, have really been spinning this issue. And here in the United States, unfortunately, the media has been buying it, but internationally there's been a bit more of an intensive look at this and more of a call for the United States to be warning the civilian populations there and cleaning up the depleted uranium.
Now, we know that there are various things that are budgeted, you know, reconstructions, contracts that are going out. Is there anything in the Pentagon's budget to do with DU cleanup?
Not as far as I know. In fact, it's interesting that the British government has said that they would be willing to provide funds to clean up depleted uranium, because the British also used depleted uranium from their tanks during this war. But the Pentagon, you know, the quote you read earlier really sums up their attitude. You know, they continue to assert there is no way anyone could get sick from depleted uranium. It doesn't pose any risk. And yet, when you look at you know, those are the words. But when you look at the deeds that they've done, we have places here in the United States that are testing ranges where they shot depleted uranium. And one good example being Aberdeen, Maryland, where the Army is undertaking a cleanup of depleted uranium there, which essentially involves removing tons of soil, scraping up maybe the top foot of soil, packaging that, and sending it to a low-level radioactive waste repository. The reason they're doing that in Aberdeen, Maryland, is because they're concerned about the depleted uranium migrating into the Chesapeake Bay.
Okay.
So that's just one example of, you know, a conduct here that they do. Yet when the Pentagon shoots depleted uranium internationally, they walk away from the problem and try to convince the public that there's nothing to worry about. There's a real disconnect there.
Depleted uranium expert Dan Fahey speaking with Mark Babawi on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Special thanks to Renee Feltz for producing that segment. As the combat phase of the invasion of Iraq winds down and U.S. troops return home, the civilians and particularly the children of Iraq continue to suffer from the lasting effects of war and 12 years of economic sanctions. One detrimental and long-lasting effect of war not often discussed in detail is the psychological effects of war on children's emotional and psychological well-being. Dr. Manny Rondalen is a professor at the University of Berkeley in California, and he works at the Center for Crisis Psychology. Dr. Rondalen is part of the international study team that produced a comprehensive report on the humanitarian effects of the Gulf War entitled Our Common Responsibility, the Impact of a New War on Iraqi Children. His group's findings have been acknowledged as the most comprehensive study of the impact of war on civilians. He spoke recently with Armando Gudino on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
If we go back to the study we did in Iraq, which was representative for other studies, the state of life danger, and especially repeated life danger, is affecting the brain mechanism, especially the fear centers, the fight and flight centers, and also the worldview and the basic trust of the child. What is happening in this situation is that the whole body is mobilizing for survival, and there is no use for this because they are, of course, powerless. They cannot fight the bombs or whatever is going on during a war. So then the whole system is activated and activated again, and these are stored, these memories, or this film, I will say, the big horror film of what is going on, is stored in the memory, and from there it is causing the much trouble. I will describe it in a short while, but going back to the 91 children in Iraq, this war hit a family that was not so bad off. Actually, everyone were going to school. There were health services for 96% in the families. There was the lowest death infant mortality rate in the Middle East. Actually, in UNICEF, we called Iraq in the 90s for the Middle East, Brazil. At that time, children and parents, they had some strength. After 12 years with sanctions and depletion of the resources of the family, with the fear and the depression of the children, with malnutrition, depleted the reservoirs for brain building molecules and energy. This time, the bombs are falling on a family already lying down. And, of course, the trauma impact will be disastrous and much stronger than earlier. And that was also was signaled during our pre-war study. But back to your question, what characteristics or the feature of a traumatized child is, number one, that is the repeated return of the worst memory coming like sounds, like pictures, like strong waves of feelings. And this is disturbing the whole system, and especially the emotional brain of the child. Actually might destabilize it for a lifetime if nothing is done to that. The second is that they try desperately to avoid all sort of reminders. But this is to run. It is they run, but mentally they have no place to hide. The trauma is hunting them down everywhere. And the third is that they have a very strong increased level of arousal, so they are very jumpy, and they are jumpy for all the unexpected things. Even if it's bombing that caused the high arousal, they jump if somebody come unexpected and a little swift through a door. And the fourth is that they may be numb, psychologically numb, and show no feeling at all, and that could go into serious dissociation disorders and cause personality sufferings and disorder of a very serious type. These are the main features, and added to that, we have all the sleep problems, we have the sadness, and then, of course, we have depression and panic states and the whole specter of signs showing that this is a person in distress and a person severely mentally affected, and this might last for life. Childhood lasts for life because the brain lasts for life.
Doctor, at how early an age does a child begin to develop this kind of trauma? Is it the age of 2, 3, 4, when the child is able to understand what's going on? How early an age have you been able to detect in your experiences in Iraq children already suffering of this?
Actually, the data we have at the lowest age are, well, let's say it's a little anecdotal, but there are many anecdotes, and it's from your own city. Is from Los Angeles, where we have seen in detail reports for children who were down to 14 months that they had horror pictures in their mind, sort of filmed with no word on, of ceilings coming down from the earthquake and screaming and dust. Some of the children had no idea that this was dangerous, but for others it had evoked the early developed fear center in the brain, and they actually had early established destabilization. When they get older, they were able to put word to this. Down to 14 months is still, as I say, anecdotal, but we are sure that it could be established at the age of 2.
Doctor, as the child progresses and becomes a bit older and enters a teenage and adolescent years, what, if any, implications will that have for an entire generation of children who are living in such forms of disparity, psychological effects in terms of the political environment? Do we see a potential here for children to lash out against people of their own or against, in this particular case, a foreign government who's in their country? Is this going to breed a generation of children willing to take personal action?
The fifth in the statistical, the data statistical manual, the fifth feature or characteristic of trauma is anger. And that comes from the unpleasant feeling that it is caused and stored deep in the brain. Anger is sort of unpleasantness that turns into anger and that can turn into aggression. If I should say that what is characteristic of traumatized people, whether they are children or adults, is that untreated, they have problems in controlling and modulating their emotions. They might get angry and then they attack. They might get a little anxious and then they go quickly into panic and they are a little sad and they go into the black hole of depression. It is like a mini emotion turned into a maxi reaction. Then you can figure out for yourself if you don't do anything about this. And what's going on in Baghdad now, how you could, if anybody had a fantasy that is the way to create long life friendship with anyone from the age of 2 and upwards, I wonder which sort of books of psychology they have read. That must be a special edition of the collected wisdom of Donald Rumsfeld.
Dr. Mani Rondolin is a professor at the University of Berkeley. His international study team produced a comprehensive report on the humanitarian effects of the war, the Gulf War, entitled Our Common Responsibility, the Impact of a New War on Iraqi Children. He was speaking with Armando Godinho on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Special thanks also to Fidel Rodriguez for preparing that segment. For a copy of Dr. Mani Rondolin's group's report, you can go to www.warchild.com. Corporate media networks have come under fire from progressives for their pro-Pentagon coverage of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, spoke about the role of media at the Black Voices for Peace rally Friday in the nation's capital. Goodman points out how the mainstream media marginalized anti-war voices in its coverage and failed to actually portray the realities and horrors of war.
The day the bombs started to fall on Iraq, Dan Rather said, "Good morning, Baghdad." Tom Brokaw said, "We don't want to destroy the infrastructure of Iraq because we're going to own that country in a few days." Peter Jennings was interviewing an ABC reporter on the streets of New York because that night thousands of people in New York, as well as around the country and around the world, many more, gathered in Times Square in the freezing rain to say no to war. Peter Jennings questioned his reporter, Chris Cuomo, the son of the former New York governor, and said, "What are they doing out there?" And he said, "Well, they carry signs that say things like, 'No blood for oil.' But when you ask them what they mean, they seem confused. They don't really understand." Why didn't Peter Jennings invite one of them into the studio? Because he would have broken the tradition of the networks that have, it seems, put up a sound barrier against anyone opposed to war. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study in the week leading up to General Colin Powell making his case for war at the UN Security Council, and the week afterwards, a two-week period when most people in this country were opposed to an invasion. FAIR did a study of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, CBS Evening News, ABC Nightly News, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, the four major newscasts. They did 393 interviews with people around the war. Three of the close to 400 interviews were anti-war voices. Three. It is not only Pacifica Radio that uses the public airwaves. All of the networks do, and they have a responsibility in a democratic society to present the views of the diversity of America. It is actually quite astounding that so many people are opposed to war in this country when you have more than 90% of the media, what you hear, then not only on the broadcast networks, but on cable, fiercely beating the drums for war. We need independent media, and there is no more important time than when this country is involved in an endeavor that takes the lives of thousands, not only people abroad, but people who die right here at home. People like Kendall Damon Watersby, who comes from Baltimore, right next door. I saw his father for a minute on CNN, Michael Watersby. He was holding up a photograph of his son, one of the first to die in the invasion of Iraq, saying, "George Bush, look what you have taken from me." And Kendall Damon Watersby's sister talked about blood for oil. We didn't see much of them after that. It is a dark day for American journalism. Today, I'm thinking about people like Tariq Ayoub, who is the Al Jazeera reporter, who died in his office in Baghdad, even when Al Jazeera had given the coordinates of the office to the Pentagon over and over again, maybe that was their mistake. And I'm thinking about the reporters and the cameramen who died at the Palestine Hotel, a hotel packed with hundreds of international reporters. Everyone knew it around the world because that's where they were broadcasting from. And the U.S. military shelled the hotel. What was the response of mainstream media in this country? Compare it, for example, to Spain, where the Spanish journalists, the elite ones, the cameramen, the reporters on TV, the media workers, went to Parliament, and when the Prime Minister walked in, they put down the tools of their trade, their cameras and their cables, their pens and their pencils and their pads, and they turned their backs and they refused to take the notes of the powerful, and they said, shame, because two of their own from Spain, Jose Cuso of Telecinco, and Julio Anguita Parado, reporter for Spanish newspaper El Mundo, had died in the shelling of the Palestine Hotel. And then they went outside, hundreds of media workers, outside the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, and they shut down the intersection, and they turned to the embassy, and they shouted, murderer, murderer. The media in this country has to take a stand against the murder of their own and then fairly and accurately report what war looks like. It is hell. It is gore. It is blood. We asked Aaron Brown why they don't show the pictures. And if in Vietnam, one of the pictures that turned the war around was that picture of the little girl burning from napalm, would we see that today on an American network? He said we have to question the photos and determine whether or not they are tasteless. Well, the answer to Aaron Brown and all of the other reporters on the mainstream networks is war is tasteless. And if the networks, the commercial networks in this country, ever dare to show the truth, war would be eradicated in a week. Americans are a compassionate people, and they would not stand for little Iraqi girls and boys, men and women, being killed in the name of oil.
Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Thanks to Chris Strom from the IMC DC and Reem Kadhuda, Peace Watch producer for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, for that report. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. Our engineer today was T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Josh Chaffin, Adam Campy, and Benta Berklin. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. We urge you to make your pledge of support through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.